Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and thank you for joining us today. I just finished talking to Brett Sheehan about his really fascinating new book, Industrial Eden, A Chinese Capitalist Vision. This was published by the Harvard University Press in 2015. And don't let the title fool you. The idea of China... Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and thank you for joining us today. I just finished talking to Brett Sheehan about his really fascinating new book, Industrial Eden, A Chinese Capitalist Vision. This was published by the Harvard University Press in 2015. And don't let the title fool you. The idea of Chinese capitalism in the title is very much a placeholder for a much more complex and complicated argument that unfolds over the course of the book that actually holds that there is no single Chinese capitalism. And in fact, if we do what Sheehan has done over the course of this book and trace very intimately the history of particular figures, particular families, and the way that they dealt with, in this case, changing regimes, changing circumstances, and just really tried to stay afloat and manage and grow their businesses, we'll see that there is no single Chinese capitalism. In fact, dealing on the ground with the very challenging and the very complex phenomena that were brought about in the history of the political and the cultural and economic history of modern China really spurred very different kinds of, very hybrid kinds of practices that really can't be subsumed under the single overarching broad category of Chinese capitalism. So the book does a really brilliant job at weaving together a history of a very character-driven kind of family story of what it meant for the Song family to live through and to prosper and also sometimes not prosper through a series of five different authoritarian regimes. But also it's a story about sort of the economic and political history of business over the 20th century in China. It's super fascinating. It's based on a really, really interesting and very multiple and plural set of sources that range, as you'll hear, from published fiction and histories, newspapers, to oral histories, missionary archives, family papers, corporate records, and much, much more. It's a really fascinating story, and it was a pleasure to talk with Brett about it. So I hope you enjoy, and I'm grateful as ever for your listening. Thanks for your support, and enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Brett Sheehan about his new book, Industrial Eden. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Brett, and thanks very much for making the time to talk with me today. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thank you very much, Carla. It's a pleasure to be here. Great.
So, Brett, could you start us off by really just saying a little bit about what brought you to the field of modern Chinese history?
I took a kind of circuitous path. I had a previous career and a previous life as a banker. My undergraduate degree is in finance, and I worked for a commercial bank as a commercial loan analyst for 6 years. But I always wanted to be a historian, ever since I can remember. And I decided in the late 1980s to go back to graduate school and to study history. And I even called a professor of mine who had been an inspiration. I had taken an elective course in Chinese history as an undergraduate. And I called him and talked to him. And he said, well, you know, if you get a PhD in history, you have to choose a field. This is how clueless I was. And I said, well, I guess I'll do Chinese history then. And this was, 1987. China was not China. It's not the China that we know today. It was just kind of, it just seemed interesting to me. And I had never been to China. I spoke not a word of Chinese. And I didn't know that you don't, at the age of 28, learn Chinese and get a PhD in Chinese history. And because I didn't know that, it was impossible. I did it.
I love it. I love the story. So the book itself that we're talking about today, it's a really, really interesting exploration of a bunch of related phenomena that are happening at the same time. So it gives us a window into kind of cultural history, political history, economic history, and family history in some really interesting intersecting ways that we'll get to in the hour to come. So it looks specifically at the interwoven histories of capitalism, and I'm putting this in kind of conceptual scare quotes because what capitalism is going to mean, how it's going to mean, its multiple meanings is very much something that's going to unfold over time. But the interwoven histories of capitalism and the Song family under a series of five successive authoritarian governments in North China. So what brought you to this particular topic? How did you decide to not only write about this issue, but write a book-length object that treated this subject?
After I finished the first book, which is about money and banking in the northern city of Tianjin in the Republican period, I swore to myself that I was going to choose a topic with a very focused set of sources that were not as diffuse as the first book. And simultaneous with that, my wife had actually met when we were living in Berkeley when I was doing my PhD. My wife had met Roberta Song, the daughter of Song Peiqing. And Roberta kept telling her that, I had this father that did all these interesting things. And she would tell me, I met Roberta and her father did all these interesting things. You should meet up. And I did take the opportunity well after the first book was underway to sit down with her and learn that Song Peiqing had been this really key figure, not just in Tianjin, but in China, who had a kind of symbolic importance beyond what his perhaps economic standing might have been. And I thought, great, one person, maybe he and his father, two people, one basic company, simple story, simple set of sources, a great project. It was only as I began doing it that the framework of the sort of five authoritarian regimes came clear to me, and I realized that this was actually going to be more difficult than the first book, that the sources were more diffuse, harder to find, and that each regime has its own sources. Mm-hmm. As you know, virtually every book set in the first half of the 20th century in China has a beginning or an end date of 1911, mm-hmm. 1927, 1937, 1931, 1945, 1949. And so to write a book which crossed all of those regimes, because people's lives cross those regimes, this was the advantage to me of actually focusing on individuals, named individuals with their own life histories. Their lives crossed those regimes, and so history didn't just stop at the beginning and end of those regimes. And so it became both more interesting to me and much more difficult to do as I began to frame it that way.
Yeah, I mean, the range of kinds of sources that you talk about early in the book that you encountered and worked through and worked with for the book include family papers, missionary archives, corporate records, government documents, oral histories, interviews, novels, newspapers, and much more. So we're talking about not just a really kind of amazing span of time, and not just a span of different kinds of ways that each one of these regimes kept records, is reflected in these records, but also a range of different, very, very different kinds of sources and media. So it's a really impressive accomplishment on that, along those lines as well.
Thank you.
So the book opens with a journey. And for listeners who haven't had a chance to read it, I want to say just explicitly right off the bat, it's also a really fabulous read. It's really clear, it's really engaging, and it reads very much in a way that doesn't just emphasize the importance of the historical and conceptual phenomena that you're talking about, but also does really beautiful things with character and character development. So it's a really fun read, as well as being a really attentive history book. But it opens with a journey, and this journey is in the late 1870s. It's a poor 7-year-old peasant boy who leaves his home in Shandong to go to school in another village. Now, this boy was Song Chuandian, and as we follow his story and that of his son and his family, the business that they open and develop and operate, we also follow the story of business and politics in a very tumultuous period of modern Chinese history. We look at how the category of the nature of businessmen itself were formed, and we also look at the usage of the term and concept of capitalism in this context. So we'll get to Song when we'll get to that school in a moment, but let's first set the stage here for listeners by talking about one of these key terms, and that is capitalism. You call members of the Song family capitalists without capitalism. So since this seems to be really important, could you talk a little bit about what that means? What does it mean to call them capitalists without capitalism, and what's important for us to understand about that?
Certainly. There's a lot of different debate in the scholarly literature about what the meaning of capitalism is, whether it is a focus primarily on markets, and usually free markets. The freer the market, the more capitalist the system is often assumed to be, or whether there's some association between capitalism and democracy or a particular kind of political system. And even on this, even theorists who say there is no direct relationship between democracy and capitalism still have, as I show in the introduction, and especially in one of the footnotes, even have an underlying assumption that there is a link between democracy and capitalism. And what I found was that if you look at the first half of the 20th century, and even in the course of the second half of the 20th century, there are very few free markets, that the state is heavily involved in economic decisions, and that the idea of some sort of idealized capitalism is simply not there. Their capitalism is a term that intrudes on people's lives in the late 1930s and 1940s, and is used as a way of organizing knowledge, as a way of classifying people, as a way of criticizing people, and sometimes as a way of promoting a particular vision of the world. So it isn't a set of economic relations so much as it is a cultural construction.
Thank you so much. So this is actually really very much in the spirit of the kind of work that the book does on many levels. It's not just giving us a really compelling narrative history, but it's also upending some pretty common assumptions that are germane, not just to the particular business history of China, but also that are germane to how we think about China in the context of global history, in the context of global capitalism more generally. So as laid out in the introduction, the book is going to make four arguments. Many of these are about upending assumptions. The first of these arguments is that the evidence of the Song family allows us to understand imperialism, and this is both European imperialism and Japanese imperialism, on the Chinese economy in a new way. It brought both opportunities and challenges. The second argument is that there's no single culturally determined idea of or set of Chinese business practices. We're going to see as we follow through this story very different, very hybrid ways of thinking about and practicing business among the Song family members. There's also a third argument, which is that controlling the narrative of, as you say it, now I'm going to use your words in the book, the place of business in society became both a business strategy and a political tool that was tinged with moral and patriotic concerns. And then finally, the book argues that though the authoritarian governments that ruled China in the 20th century varied very widely, over time, Chinese states and also business people came to accept and increasingly to expect an increasingly intrusive government role in business. Okay, so as we get through the chapters, we're going to see some of these arguments unfold. Now, the first chapter takes us back to the 1870s and 1880s to understand how the Song family rose and how they got into the business profession. Here we go back to little Song Chuan Dian, our little seven-year-old boy, who goes to school not in his home village, but instead in the Qingzhou County seat. And we learn more about how that happened, why that happened, and what was important about this. Now, it turns out that this other school was run by missionaries. So can you open out this story for us by talking about this school? What was important about this school, and how did this lay the foundation for what Song Chuan Dian wound up doing as he grew up?
Certainly. This part of Shandong province was the arena of activity of British Baptist missionaries. Generally, the Protestant sect, when they were conducting their missionary work in the late 19th century in China, would sort of agree among themselves, either formally or informally, where they were going to work. And so you had Presbyterians kind of on the northern coast of Shandong, and the British Baptists had staked out this space in sort of central Shandong around Qingzhou. And they first located their mission in Qingzhou because they did not have permission from the Qing government to locate in the relatively nearby provincial capital of Jinan. And Qingzhou was a pretty sleepy little town, and the Song family village was a very sleepy little village a long way from that town. The first missionaries who came were startled by the poverty which they confronted. And as soon as they arrived, they began trying to find ways to deal with this, setting up orphanages, and concomitant with that, not just providing aid, but trying to teach people to the skills of what they would consider modern life, or the skills of the Industrial Revolution, as a means of trying to alleviate poverty and give people a way out of this situation. So it was a kind of a social gospel that they brought, one that was not just involved with saving souls, but one which is also involved in trying to alter the material well-being of their constituents.
Now, Song becomes involved in a lace-making business that's run by a missionary wife who helped run the school. And by doing this, he eventually helps found the Dechang Lace Company. Now, eventually, they added hairnets to their business profile. And so we go from lace, we go from this just, you know, study at this school to a lace business to then moving into hairnets. Because it's such an important part of this story seems to be a movement from one kind of product to another that gives us insight into where the market was going, what was happening politically, what was happening in the larger context in which these product decisions were being made. Can you say just very briefly what's important about this hairnet decision? Why hairnets, and what happens with that?
Well, you know, hairnets and lace share a lot of qualities. They are very labor intensive. They require knotting, K-N-O-T-T-I-N-G, knotting. And, you know, it's very close work, and it's work that needs, that is sort of associated with what we might think of as middle class or bourgeois life in the Western or developed countries in the sort of Euro-America modern world. And it would be something that a middle class woman missionary would know how to do. To make lace, or, you know, that's the kind of thing that she would be able to teach. The move from that to hairnets was demand-driven. As the fashion for hairnets came in the 19-teens and 1920s, it became a standard for Western women of a certain class, say the middle and upper classes, to have a hairnet on virtually every day. The hairnets were made of human hair, which was supposed to match the hair of the wearer. And so at the beginning, they would import Western hair because they needed blonde hair and red hair and brunette hair. Later on, they used Chinese hair, and they developed techniques of stripping the darker color out and dyeing it to match their consumers. And so there was this fad in the Western world, which needed an infinite supply, practically, of hairnets, and they capitalized on the vast pools of labor that were available in the Shandong countryside to do this.
Great. So expanding the business profile to incorporate Hairnets becomes the basis for what is then an expanding business empire. And this, that as we follow this expansion, we follow Song as he becomes a politician, and then we follow what happens to him in the wake of a takeover by a warlord, Zhang Zongchang, the dog meat general.
Yeah.
As he becomes Shandong military governor, there's a warrant for the arrest of Song and his family. There's a warrant for the confiscation of their property. All seems to be falling apart. But then they flee to the foreign concessions in Tianjin and they rebuild. And this takes us into the next chapter. So Song Chuandian dies shortly after he and the family flee to Shandong, and the job of rebuilding the family fortune falls on his son, Song Feiqing. Now, he was a member of the May 4th movement, and you mentioned that through him we can start to understand the impacts of this movement on business people. So along those lines, can you introduce Song Feiqing in this early stage for us? How is he important for us to understand May 4th and business people, and what's he like as he starts to embark on this increasingly expanding business empire?
Certainly. Song Feiqing is Song Chuandian's oldest son. And he was born in and grew up in the same central Shandong area that his father did, went to, as a child to the same missionary school that his father did, but then was sent first to Beijing and then to Shanghai for education and eventually to the United States to sort of learn about the world, comes back, you know, right after the May 4th movement, joins his father in his business, is eventually, as you say, exiled to Tianjin by the advent of the nationalist regime and the change in warlord governments, and sets out to try to create a business that is on a slightly different model than that of his father. His father used vast pools of low-skill labor in the countryside to create items for foreign consumption. What Song Feiqing wants to do is create a modern industrial enterprise, one that uses Industrial Revolution kinds of equipment and makes modern consumer products for the Chinese market. And he sees both the nature of this enterprise, the kind of technology and equipment he wants to use, and the kind of products that he wants to sell, in this case, wool knitting yarn, as all integral parts of the same vision of modernity. And so rather than a vision of modernity that involves debates, you know, sort of May 4th debates about, you know, anarchism or socialism or the other kinds of things that we learn about in the rise of the Communist Party or other kinds of movements, we see here a sort of industrial modernist take on the May 4th movement, which shows something as potentially humble as knitting yarn as a part of a kind of radical modernity that is going to salvage China. You know, this is where we get into the Industrial Eden vision, one which will save China.
That's right. So this is happening. In the context of Song Feiqing launching this Dongya Corporation that we'll hear a lot more about in the 1930s, the incorporation of North China into a nationalist regime and a kind of divide in economic policy that's concomitant with that. So there's this divide where Chiang Kai-shek wants to base economy on heavy industry to serve the military. The Wang Jingwei faction, as you describe it here in the chapter, wants a more centralized economy that's going to resist Japanese imperialism. And this kind of encroaching Japanese imperialism helps launch, or is the context in which we see the launching of the national products movement. Now, this is the context in which Song Feiqing and Dongya are turning to wool textiles and to yarn in particular. So this is actually pretty important. What's happening with this national products movement, and how does yarn come out of that?
The idea of the national products movement is to buy Chinese-made goods, rather than to buy imports, and specifically rather than to buy Japanese imports. You know, it's not always directed at Japanese, but that really is, by the mid-1930s, the main foreign competitor that people are seeing. And wool knitting yarn is something that I believe Song Feiqing came into contact with as a child with the missionaries. I can't actually prove that. I think it's highly likely. China itself does not have a history of hand knitting wool, and very little history of wearing wool textiles, actually. And so He's buying into a Western discourse of modernity, which sees wool as hygienic and modern, and knitting as sort of both frugal and modern, that he is trying to sort of tie to his industrial project.
Great. So in this context, Dolnya starts promoting their knitting yarn as a national product, right? And it's called Budding Ram Wool Knitting Yarn. Now, this is, you just mentioned that this is part of, and it's embedded within this larger vision, right? This marketing vision and a notion of an industrial Eden. So this is the chapter of the book. This is super crucial for understanding what Song Feiqing and Dolnya are doing in this period. So let's get right there. Industrial Eden. What is that, and what do we need to understand about that particular vision to understand what's happening for Song and for Dolnya in this part of the story?
Okay. First of all, let me say that Song Feiqing is not the only person in China doing these similar kinds of experiments at this time. He is one of them, and perhaps one of the best known of them. But this is a very wide movement across industries and across different parts of China. And I divide Industrial Eden into two different parts, but they're all part and parcel of what I think of as redemptive industrialization. The idea that industrialization is going to save the individual and the nation. And so in the 1930s, the most salient manifestation of Industrial Eden, and Industrial Eden, by the way, is the term that I have coined to call these various redemptive industrial experiments. And I think it's a particularly apt in Song Feiqing's case because he has kind of a Christian-tinged vision because of his Christian beliefs and his experience and his father's experiences with the British Baptist missionaries. But I do think Industrial Eden is a much broader phenomenon. So in the 1930s, the most salient manifestation of the Industrial Eden vision is what I call Industrial Eden outside of the firm, creating a modern world in which, and it's aimed particularly at housewives, bringing housewives into the center of Chinese modernity, who are running a scientific, hygienic, and modern household. And of course, the knitting yarn is sold as part and parcel of this modern household.
And they also launch a family magazine, right, as part of this ARC Monthly, which I think fits into this larger framework you're talking about. Yeah.
And the ARC, the fact that it's called the ARC,
right,
both reflects his own Christian beliefs as well as the idea that China needs to be saved. That if we can get on this modern, you know, the ship of modernity, we will all be saved from the deluge of China's internal and external crises. Mm-hmm.
Right. So what happens here in this context is the knitting yarn market becomes really, really competitive. Economic considerations become actually more important in some ways than patriotism in driving the market. And into this context, we have the Japanese occupation. And as we move to Chapter 4, we move to the context of what's happening in light of the Japanese occupation. So how did what are some of the most important ways that the Japanese occupation immediately impacted what was happening at Dolnya?
In a large variety of ways. Number one, there's another political regime, right? So this is our third political regime. We had the warlords in Shandong. We had the nationalists in the 1930s when he was in Tianjin. And now we have the Japanese occupation regime and the puppet government, the provisional regime in Beijing. And so there's a political change, and that means new laws, new political authorities to deal with those kinds of things. There's an economic change. China's market becomes much more fragmented. And so the dreams that they had in the 1930s of selling to a national Chinese market, it becomes a much more regional North China market. At the same time, his company, all of Tianjin and all of North China, is caught up in Japanese planning for a Japanese-centered model of industrial development, in which Chinese industrialists and Chinese people have kind of a peripheral role in the support of the rise of the Japanese Empire.
So you actually talk about this kind of transformation to the state being run as part of a Japanese developmental empire. So the developmental model here is an important term for listeners. This is one of the ways that the book describes the kinds of engagements economically that some of these regimes are taking. And over time, the new state becomes not just developmental, but increasingly extractive. And I'm just highlighting the term extractive here because along with developmental, these are some of the main terms that we're using here to understand the economic policies that these successive states are undertaking and the ways that those policies are then, and the contexts that they're creating are then going to impact Dongya and beyond. Now, Dongya managers become experts in this context in participating in a new economy of things, as you put it. So they sort of start to produce things that are, as you describe here, essential to everyday survival, but not so important that they're going to invite direct Japanese control. And in this context, they start developing gunny sacks, and they start producing medicine. So for listeners who aren't as familiar with this idea of the economy of things that you're evoking here, can you talk a little bit about that? What is this larger economy of things, and how does this impact the production of or the move by Dongya to produce gunny sacks and medicine?
Okay. The economy of things is a product of both Japanese economic regulation and inflation. So that the Japanese tried to impose certain kinds of purchasing price controls and tried to allocate resources in certain ways that made it sort of forced an underground economy where things were bartered for other things and things became important in ways that they were not before. At the same time, we have rising inflation throughout the period of the Japanese occupation, especially in the later years, when holding money, in this case, the money issued by the Japanese Central Reserve Bank, or the puppet regime Central Reserve Bank, holding money was not very wise because it would become devalued so quickly under inflation. And so it was better to convert that money to things. And about halfway through the war, Song Pei-ching realizes he will no longer be able to import the Australian wool he needs to make high-quality knitting yarn, and they need a new product. And almost by happenstance, they are able to purchase equipment to make gunny sacks. And I don't know if you remember this. When I was a child, I remember gunny sacks. We used to, when we raked up the grass clippings, and you know, after mowing the lawn, we would put them in gunny sacks, and they would empty them into trash cans when the trash people came. But you know, in the 1930s and 40s, the gunny sack was essential. You know, there were no containers, there were no container ships. The idea of the pallet hadn't, you know, and you know, moving things around on pallets hadn't happened. So almost all kind of small friable goods were moved in gunny sacks. So that's any type of grain, soybeans, cement, anything like that had to be transported, put on the ships, put on the trains, put on the trucks in gunny sacks. And so they were actually a vital product. But like I say, not something like a chemical factory that would be clearly the Japanese would say, we're going to take that over. It's just, we need gunny sacks. Here's your gunny sack producer. Can we kind of deal with him?
Great. Thank you so much. And I want to highlight this also because I think there's an increasing, really across humanistic and historiographic fields, there's an increasing attention to a more object and things-centered way of telling stories. And this is a really interesting perspective to bring to a larger kind of history of things and with things and objects that really embeds it really nicely within a larger political and economic history. So I really appreciated that about what's happening in this chapter and also in the chapters to come. Now, as we move into the fifth chapter, we move into a really, really fascinating picture of life inside the firm. So this chapter takes us into really the particular managerial strategy that Song is bringing to Dongya. It takes us into the processes of selection and then training of applicants for positions at Dongya, and it's super, super interesting. And it's also really, I think, important for fleshing out the picture that you started the book with, at least in part, which is, you know, emphasizing the importance of these hybrid modes of what we might call capitalist practices and the ways that they played out for Song in particular. So we see in this firm, as you call it, an incorporation of both Christian and Confucian methods and ideas into Song's business practices. So maybe to start us off here, can you say a little bit about that? When you say there's an incorporation of Christianity and Confucianism in ways into the way he's running his business, what does that look like on the ground?
Certainly. And so this chapter is about creating the industrial Eden vision inside the firm and seeing the firm as kind of a microcosm or a model for the rest of society. That firm you will be able to transform, by transforming the firm, it will then sort of spread outward into society and transform society from the bottom up. At the same time that the consumer products and publications and magazines are trying to create modern consumer society outside the firm. And this world that he creates, and this is what he's best known for, although I have a slightly revisionist approach to understanding this, is a world in which he has a series of very enlightened, or at least on the surface, potentially enlightened personnel policies. He creates schools for the children of his employees. He has after work clubs and sporting events and teams. Employees are supposed to wear uniforms. They have employee housing where they can live. They are taught to in training lectures. Under the category of spiritual training, which is a term that was widely used by Sun Yat-sen and others in the nationalist movement, they have spiritual training. And to be a good Dongya employee, you need to study these spiritual training lectures and actually take tests on them. And spiritual training ranges from everything from showing up on time to work to bowing to your superiors to singing the company song and saluting the company flag.
Now, to get a job at Dongya, this was an extraordinarily intensive, it seems like, and a very, very competitive process. So you outline here in the book the process by which more than 1,000 applicants are whittled down to, I think, half a dozen actual employees. And then this involves anything from, like, calling the name of these applicants and watching how they walked across the stage, right? And so a whole bunch, like hundreds of applicants are cut out of the process right there for not embodying, quote, Dongya spirit in the way they walk across the stage, right? And from there, we've got psychological testing, physical exams, language tests, dexterity exercises, and one of the criteria looks at what their limbs are like, right? Are they missing any limbs? Are there any obvious handicaps? I mean, just the process of actually getting hired at this corporation is super duper fascinating. So what was, in terms of learning about that process, what was the source base for this chapter like for you? It seems like this would be a chapter that was based on particularly interesting kinds of documents.
On the one hand, I have internal company records. I have all of the training lectures and the spiritual training lectures and things that they gave. I have the personnel handbook and other personnel records and things like that. There are some oral history accounts that were taken in the 1960s in the 1980s that talked about how to find work at Dongya. And then I had the manuscript of one of Song Fei-ching's executives at Dongya, a man named Shi Xiaodong, who in the 1970s, I believe, wrote by hand a manuscript of his time. And the hiring process that you just described is for the cost accounting department of all things. They're trying to find these sort of young Adonis-like figures to be cost accountants. Is something that I got from his manuscript.
I mean, it's just really fascinating. And also for listeners who are particularly interested in integrating this book into a larger history of science and technology, there's also a very careful attentiveness in this chapter to what you call a fetish of measurement that is sort of coming out of Song's interest in scientific modernity and scientific business practices. So readers or listeners who are particularly interested in integrating this with, for example, the kind of work by Tong Lam and others who have looked at measurement and the sort of rising culture of measurement will find some really interesting material here to integrate into that story. So as we move to the next chapter, chapter 6 takes us into what happened after Japan surrendered. Now, you say that Dongya here was in a good position to take advantage of peace, but how did they fare after Japan surrendered? What were some of the most important things that are happening on the eve of the post-war for Dongya?
This is potentially the most revisionist part of my book in terms of the Donghua story itself. And that is that the height of the industrial vision and the height of the company's success came under Japanese occupation and made possible by essentially wartime profiteering in having a monopoly on gunny sack production under the Japanese occupation state. And the chapter about the post-war nationalist regime is one in which I argue that there's a kind of, there's been a sea change in Chinese society that happens after the war and as a result of the war. And there's a toxic environment. It's fed partly by inflation, partly by an inattentive and incompetent nationalist government, and partly by a sort of newly competitive international arena into which they're thrown. They're no longer part of the Japanese developmental empire. They're now once again competing with, for example, American companies, which are well capitalized and well able to take advantage of this market. And so the peace that should have, you know, the Japanese surrender, peace comes to China, the national state is reinvigorated. This should have been the heyday. And this actually is a period marked mostly by labor unrest, by strikes, by strife, by unhappiness, and by events which show the essential hollowness of someone's attempt to build industrial Eden.
Right. Can you say a little bit more about labor unrest in this period? That's a really striking part of this chapter, and it really is a very engaging part of the story, I think.
Yeah. This is fed partly by the fact that they hired so many people during the war, and so they had a lot of young laborers who had not been with the firm very long and who were used to the kinds of benefits that were made possible by the wartime profits, also made possible by communist are also fed by communist organizing and by nationalist union organizing. And there was splits in the nationalist movement as to what they wanted in a union and how it was supposed to be done. But we end up with a very active and demanding and fragmented labor force during the post-war period, at the basis of which almost all their demands come back to the inflation. They simply cannot afford to live because, you know, what something costs today, it will not cost tomorrow.
And sort of going back to this idea of, in the language of developmentalism, right, development, you make a point here in this chapter that the post-war nationalist state is actually failing its developmental mission, as you put it, and that foreign competition really makes it almost impossible for Donghua wool yarn to compete in the marketplace. Now, what happens in wake of this is that the company eventually shifts its activity to Shanghai, and then it sets up a subsidiary in the British colony of Hong Kong, and Hong Kong's going to loom pretty importantly in the chapters to come. Now, the communists take over Tianjin on January 15th in 1949. What are the immediate impacts on Donghua when this happens?
The first impact is the peace is restored, finally. But then, you know, within days, a work team arrives at Donghua, and the local communist officials, although they're very good at sort of restoring public order, they have no idea what to do with capitalists. The mayor of Tianjin doesn't shake Song Weiqing's hand the first time he meets him because he doesn't know, is he a capitalist, you know, enemy that needs to be overthrown, or is he an ally in trying to build up a new kind of China? And so you have Donghua workers energized once again who are calling for the overthrow of capitalism, and you have Donghua management that doesn't know what state policy is, and you have local state officials who don't know what state policy is. And this is solved by the arrival of the number two man in the communist movement, Liu Shaoqi, in Tianjin.
So Liu Shaoqi visits Tianjin, and he visits Donghua in particular. And I think if I'm recalling correctly, Donghua is one of only two private firms that he visits.
Correct.
On this trip. Now, there are articles that result from this and a little bit thereafter in local and also in national news that sort of make Song Feiqing and make Donghua part of the public narrative, as you put it, of capitalism under the communists. And so what's happening in these news articles that are sort of coming out in the wake of Liu Shaoqi's visit, and what's important for us to understand about the transformation, if at all, in this part of the story that comes along with that?
There's two things. The first is that the communist leadership has decided on a temporary alliance with capitalists, at least those capitalists not directly associated with the nationalist regime. They need to get the economy moving again. The civil war is going very well, much better than anybody expected from the communist side. And so that, you know, the winning the war is no longer the issue. The issue is rebuilding the Chinese economy. And so they try to establish an alliance with capitalists, which in retrospect we know is temporary. At the time, Liu Shaoqi told Song Feicheng, you know, if you do well managing Dongya, we'll give you 8 more factories or 10 more factories to manage. Eventually, you'll turn them over to the state, but we will pay you to manage them. And, you know, everything will be fine. You know, then we have this long-term alliance going on. At the same time, Liu Shaoqi told labor, you know, rein it in. You've got to get back to work. We've got to build China. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's sort of one side of the new regime. The other side is that the communists take really effective and immediate steps to take control of China's financial system and the system of purchasing and distribution. And so although Dongya remains a private or a capitalist company under the early years of the communist regime, it is very soon enmeshed in this web of controls. It has to get all of its financing and sell all of its goods to state-owned companies. And very soon, it is actually adopting the language of socialist mobilization, trying to meet government-set targets, and really, although still making profits, becomes a cog in the socialist machine.
Right. So the story is, of course, not just about Dongya, but it also becomes very much about Song Feicheng. And by this point in the story, I think we really care about him as a character. We care about him as a figure. And what happens to him personally in this period is really interesting. So he leaves for Hong Kong. What happens for him in Hong Kong? What's going on there that's important to the story?
As you mentioned a moment ago, a few years before the communists took over in mainland China, Song Feicheng had established a subsidiary in Hong Kong. It was kind of a subterfuge because he wanted to move capital and assets and sort of a base of operations to Hong Kong without anyone really knowing that he was potentially had this kind of backup plan. He arrives in Hong Kong. Eventually, his family is smuggled out of China and arrives in Hong Kong as well, only to find that his local partner there has not been as cooperative or is not being as cooperative as he once hoped. He also finds that he's being hounded. He's being watched by both communist agents and by national agents sent from Taiwan. And the market for knitting yarn is not as good as he had hoped. And really, he spent more and more time in his visions of some sort of industrial Eden utopia. When Shi Xiaodong visits with him in Hong Kong once, he talks about establishing a self-sufficiency island somewhere in, you know, Hong Kong has a number of smaller islands where people live in a communal lifestyle and produce and create together. And then eventually he moves to Argentina, one of the few places he can go. Because he's associated with cooperation with the communists, he's in an increasingly Red Scare America. He's not welcome in the United States, but he can go to Argentina, along with large numbers of Chinese. He goes to Argentina, begins plans to build another industrial Eden Vision kind of place in Brazil, but unfortunately dies a kind of broken and disillusioned man in Argentina after only a few years.
Yeah, wow. Thank you for that. But that's, of course, not the end of the story. Now, there's a final chapter before the conclusion that looks at the public vision and the public identity of the company and also of Song Feicheng. And this is a really fascinating chapter. So I want to make sure that we have time to talk about this. Now, the public identity of the company is tied to yarn. We've talked about this vision of it as the kind of purveyor of budding ram yarn. And yarn, as you've shown throughout the book, is this modern consumer product. But effectively and in truth, and I think you make this point importantly and very effectively in this chapter, they made much of their income not on yarn, but on gunny sacks, right?
Correct. And for many years, they were not able to produce yarn, at least half of the period over which I studied between the founding of the company and the Communist Revolution. They were not producing any yarn at all.
Right. So there's another phenomenon, and another sort of interestingly complex phenomenon that's happening in this chapter that has to do with public vision. And this is the changing understanding and the changing kind of public and private understanding of Song Fei-Ching as a capitalist. Now, in the course of this chapter, he goes from being painted as a bad capitalist to being celebrated as a model capitalist. And this move from bad capitalist to model capitalist takes us into also some really, really interesting sources and some fictional sources. So let's talk about that. How does he become attacked as a bad capitalist? And what's the context that's important for us to understand that produces that attack?
So after Song Fei-Ching leaves for Hong Kong, Dong Yao continues, under a new directorate. And the really initial attacks on Song Fei-Ching come in the three anti and five anti campaigns. And these eventually become a very vociferous attack on him. And there's this huge exhibition talking about the crimes that he and others committed at Dong Yao against the state, which ranged everything from having sort of foreign made toys and hairbrushes to exploiting their workers. Mm-hmm. And then, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go on, I'm sorry.
This kind of attack is then repeated in successive waves throughout the Maoist period and reaches a height once again during the Cultural Revolution. And over this period, once in 1958 and again right before the Cultural Revolution, there are publications, one purporting to be a history, another clearly written as a novel, both kind of fictionalized accounts of the Dong Yao Corporation. One is called Spring Returns to the Earth, and the other one is called A Civilized Hell.
So can you talk a little bit about these sources? Because the Spring Returns to the Earth and the novel A Civilized Hell both seem really, really interesting, just in terms of how we work with them as historians to weave part of the story. So for you, what were some of the most interesting things about one or both of these materials in terms of the work that you are doing here in this chapter?
What really strikes me is the fact that capitalism did not disappear under socialist construction, that, perhaps private companies were first enmeshed in socialist controls. Eventually, with the social transformation in the mid-50s, they became state-owned enterprises. There was virtually none. Of course, in China is a big place, you can never say none, but there was virtually no private business or private enterprise of any kind. But the status of private business and private enterprise remained at the center of public discourse. And there were movies and novels and accounts and oral histories taken, a constant stream of things produced by CCP propagandists, Communist Party propagandists, to justify the regime in terms of the overthrow of capitalism. And these two books are part of that, one at the time of the Great Leap Forward and once right before the Cultural Revolution.
Great. Now, by the 1990s, as we come to kind of the end of this story, Song Fei-Ching turns from being, attacked as a bad capitalist to being celebrated as a model capitalist. So how is that happening, and what are the most important sources for you in showing that transformation?
Right. So after Mao's death, Deng Xiaoping comes. We have the opening up and reform period, and China begins experimenting and looking for models to justify these experiments in business. And he's an obvious model because he can now be portrayed as an enlightened capitalist because he had these personnel policies that seemed to take care of his workers. So whereas in the Cultural Revolution, a civilized hell, if you're going to undermine capitalists, you have to undermine the enlightened capitalist, right? Because if he's bad, then the other capitalists are worse. Now, suddenly, the enlightened capitalist can be, maybe we can turn to private business and it won't be so bad. It will not necessarily be bad for workers. So we begin to see publications, especially in the Wen Shizhi Liao publication series, interviews with his former executives, eventually longer pieces that appear in profiles of capitalists, dictionaries, biographical dictionaries of capitalists, and things like that, that begin to celebrate the Dong Yao legacy and Song Fei-Ching's so-called enlightened policies.
So we are now at the close of the book, Brett. It's been a really interesting journey, and there's, of course, a lot that we didn't have a chance to talk about, right? It's a very, very rich book, and all of the chapters that we've talked about include much more detail and much more analysis and parts of the narrative than we've had time to talk about. Given that, though, is there anything in particular that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to become readers?
Well, I just want to talk a little bit about the structure of the book, because it does have these five different authoritarian regimes. The warlords that Song Peking's father, Song Chuandian, had established his fortune under, the national estate in its pre-war manifestation, the wartime occupation state of the Japanese, the post-war national estate, and then the very early years of the People's Republic of China. And that these five regimes creates one of the threads through which we can follow this story. And we follow it, and I characterize each regime in terms of some of the concepts that you've talked about. Was there a laissez-faire economy? Was there a developmental state, a state which is trying actively to develop the economy? Was there an extractive state, a state which sort of extracts at the cost of the economy? At the same time, we follow the separate thread of the Industrial Eden vision, and these sort of come in alternating chapters, the company and the state, and then the company and the Industrial Eden vision. And it's a structure of the book that took many years to sort of decide on, and one which I think, because we're following the story of people, actually shows us how these things develop over a relatively long period of time, and certainly through dramatic and tumultuous changes.
What other kinds of structures, since you've sort of brought up the issue of structure, were there any other kinds of structures that you tried out for the book that didn't work for various reasons, and why didn't they work? And I'm asking specifically for the sake of listeners who might be working on their own books and also struggling with the issue, which is, I think, there for all of us, of how to structure a story like this.
Well, fairly early on, the idea of the five regimes was pretty clear, and so I was going to have to tell the story of each regime. It is the Industrial Eden vision that was the problem, because I would try to incorporate it into the regime chapters in some way, because they are concurrent in time, right? The Industrial Eden vision is developing at the same time under each of these regimes. It was only when I sort of broke it out in its separate chapters that it became really clear to me that we could see both the firm in its relations with the state, and then the firm as Song Peiqing envisioned it, as a transformative engine of society, in these sort of two facets. And it was that. And it seems obvious, but in the writing of the book, it was not obvious that the Industrial Eden vision needed its own chapters. And then the legacy chapter, the chapter about the Industrial Eden legacy, makes perfect sense, because it's the continuation of that thread of the book.
And so for listeners, when you look at the table of contents, what you're going to see as a result is there are effectively, and let me know if I'm getting this wrong, but there are effectively five chapters that are going to take us into these five regimes, and they're interspersed in some ways by chapters like chapter 3, Building Eden Outside the Firm, chapter 5, Building Eden Inside the Firm, and then chapter 8, which looks at the legacy, that take on this idea of the Industrial Eden and how this is developing concurrently alongside the development of these five authoritarian regimes. Is that fairly?
Yes.
Accurate? Okay.
Yes.
So thank you. So Brett, now that you've obviously solved all the structural problems, the book is great, the book is out, and we have the benefit of reading this now, what's next for you? Is there anything that you're working on that's particularly inspiring you right now?
Yes, there is. I'm really excited about it. It's inspired in part by Industrial Eden, because, the central argument of Industrial Eden is the one about authoritarianism and capitalism, and the fact that states became increasingly intrusive in the economy, but that business people, private capitalists like Song Peiqing, became increasingly expectant of state intrusion and dependent upon. That there was no discussion of free markets. It was an expectation of a developmental kind of state. The other argument, well, there's four, but, you know, one of the other arguments has to do with this discourse on capitalism. And what I found was that even as early as the 1930s, when Song Fei-Ching was trying to justify his company and to publicize it, there was a very strong moral tinge to the arguments. You know, the kinds of accounts that I kind of grew up on, you'd read a biography of Carnegie or Rockefeller that sort of glorified the robber baron capitalists and how much money they can make and all this kind of stuff. Nobody talked about that sort of thing. It was all, can we help society? Are we helping society? Are we hurting society? You know, proponents and critics alike all had this moral tinge to their discussions of business. So I've decided to sort of take that idea and run with it and look at over a broad length of time, what I'm calling the long 20th century, throughout China. And so I'm thinking of it as business and fiction and film over China's long 20th century. And going back to the late Qing Dynasty and following it all the way up to the present and the soap opera dramas to look at how business is portrayed and whether this kind of moral argument was just a phenomenon of you know, the 30s through the 80s and 90s, or if it is embedded in longer and broader cultural frameworks.
That's also fantastic. So best of luck with those projects. I'm going to eagerly await the book, especially on business and fiction and film. That sounds fantastic. And thank you so much, Brett, for making the time. It's really been a pleasure. It's a great book, and I really appreciate your willingness to talk about it. So thanks.
You're welcome, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.